Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, we're on beer again.
Yes, what's happening with that?
And we're on two separate beers. You're drinking a High Five Terrapin IPA. I'm drinking an Elysian Split Stout. Mine's like food. You could almost chew this beer. It's so dark. Yours, on the other hand, it's nice and bubbly.
Like me.
The only thing, you said you could kind of connect the terrapin. The way I'm going with it is three of the movies we're going to talk about tonight are like a turtle had a stroke. That's how fast and fascinating they are.
Okay, fine. We'll go with that.
Did you have one?
I just was trying to figure out if there was some giant leap from a terrapin to a gorilla.
Well, excellent transition, because you have to do the heavy lifting on this week's blockbuster that I did not get to see, which is Kong Skull Island. And before we launch into that, I remember 2005's King Kong, which was Peter Jackson's King Kong, like remake of the original 1933 classic. And I remember I really liked it. There was Naomi Watts was the girl in peril, Adrian Brody, Jack Black. He gets that famous line at the end, "'Twas beauty killed the beast." And it was like a really faithful remake to the 1933 black and white claymation with Faye Ray. So I really liked it. Am I going to be disappointed?
No, actually, I think if you like that one, you probably would like this one as well. It's a different take on the story. It doesn't take place where the humans, and you know, really are the main inhabitants. It takes place on this island in the Pacific, and essentially you've got the humans coming in and invading Kong's territory. So that's sort of the twist on this one.
Is he Prince Kong at this point?
He is. He is king of the island. He is still the king. But it's a B movie. It's a B movie with a blockbuster veneer on it. And it's really good if you like a monster movie. So if you like Godzilla, it had a kind of a Jurassic Park kind of vibe going. If you like the previous King Kong movies, then I think you'll actually really enjoy this one. It's a spectacle. It's a little campy. So I think the people who haven't enjoyed it at all are the ones who didn't quite buy into the campy aspect of it and thought that maybe the acting was weak, whereas I thought the acting fit the parts. And it has Tom Hiddleston in it. And
is he one of your favorites?
You know, he's growing on me. This is like he's a leading man. He's on the verge of leading man in this one. He's up. His leading lady is Brie Larson.
So I wanted to get to that at some point. Yeah. How's my girl? How's Brie Larson?
You know, Brie, this is not Room. This did not take the range and the layers of development.
Way back in the day when we saw the Room screening, I remember it was at Georgetown, mm-hmm. and she was there giving her Q&A. And someone asked, "What's your next movie?" And she said, "I can't really tell you, but it involves Kong." And man, that seems like so long ago.
It does. And this is such a different role for her. She plays like an anti-war photographer who goes along on this expedition. So essentially, it's like it has a little bit of Apocalypse Now homages to it. The music, the soundtrack is 1970s. So it takes place like right as the Vietnam War is ending, and this government scientist, you know, in Washington decides that he's going to make a final push to be able to get a military escort to take him to this island in the Pacific to chart this island. But he knows that there's some creature there that he wants to that he also wants to find. And so this expedition of scientists and military folks end up choppering into this island, and all hell breaks loose.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the films earlier that you did. This Kong Skull Island takes place in the same universe as 2014's Godzilla. That was one with Aaron Taylor Johnson.
I missed that one.
And you didn't see that one?
Uh-uh.
I got a kick out of that. I thought it was pretty good. And they're going to make this into a thing. Next up is Godzilla 2. I think it's coming in 2018 or 2019. And then is Godzilla versus King Kong. In 2022.
So they're setting it up.
They're going to face off. I hope they throw Mothra in there somewhere. I'm wanting to talk about the choice for director here. just like Godzilla picked up an indie guy who went on to make Godzilla, and he did a good job because then he made Star Wars, The Force Awakens.
I've heard of that one.
This guy, Jordan Vogt Roberts, the only feature he's done before was from like 2013, 2014. It's a little indie called The Kings of Summer. Coming of age story.
Mm-hmm. That was cute.
So they picked him to do this. What? Why? Wow.
Yeah, that's a very
is it to
different...
save money?
I don't know, but I mean, he pulled it off. Then kudos to him.
So he made a quality Kong product.
He did. I mean, it's an IMAX. You know, we saw it in IMAX 3D. It's big. Kong is big. It's a spectacle, and there is some beauty to this island that also has these giant evil creatures lurking. So Kong's not the only like big badass creature on this island. In fact, he's probably the lesser of the evils, is what you come to learn.
Well, I remember in the 33 version and the 2005 version, he kills a dinosaur. Does he? I don't want spoilers.
There's no spoilers. But let's just say it's more like the people and the helicopters. They get tossed around like Matchbox toys. They really do, and so it's kind of hard to keep up with who all's dying and who's surviving. But the comic relief, though, I want to mention from this movie comes from John C. Reilly, and he plays this World War II veteran who had gotten stranded on that island. And so it almost has that sort of Gilligan's Island kind of feel going, where suddenly these people arrive and they're going to get him off this island. There were natives on the island as well that he had come to know and be a part of. But he knows that island, and he is the voice of the everyman in terms of, you guys are going to try and go up against Kong. You know, you don't realize you're disrupting the balance of this universe here. And so it also has Samuel L. Jackson, who just always seems to play Samuel L. Jackson as some sort of hothead.
Does he get to scream something like, I'm tired of these MF and Kongs on this MF and island?
Essentially, that's what he does. He's like, you know, we're going to show Kong who's king, that man is king. That's sort of his whole thing. And he's this, he's this army colonel who just lives for battle, and so with the war ending, he's looking for a new fight, and so he gets it with Kong. So all in all, I don't think it's for people who don't like those kinds of movies. So I think if you've enjoyed the other ones, I think you'll enjoy it, having liked the last King Kong movie and Godzilla. I think this one is on par.
Well, I looked up the critical consensus, and it's got a fresh tomato. People are saying it looks great, but the story, and especially the dialogue, is campy, a bit cheesy. Mm-hmm. So I looked at the writers, and it makes a lot of sense. There's three of them. One of them, Max Borenstein, helped write Godzilla. One of them, Derek Connolly, helped write Jurassic World. That fits. He also helped write Monster Trucks that we skipped.
Oh, yeah.
But another one, Dan Gilroy, was Oscar nominated for Nightcrawler. So I wonder what part of Kong's Skull Island he took on.
Yeah, that's an interesting choice. But that's true, though, that the story is thin. Mm. It's definitely a thin story, but you're not watching this movie for really for deep story. It's a means to an end to some degree. You do want to stay through the 10 million credits.
Is there
at the
thing
end.
At the end?
There is a thing at the end, which makes it very clear that a sequel is not far behind.
Well, speaking of thin plots, thin movies, thin everything, and horrible everything, our next film, The Ottoman Lieutenant. I will just go ahead and spoil it for you. This movie's garbage. Movie is garbage.
I'd call it weak. It's not garbage. It's just weak.
Taking place 1914, right before the outset of World War I, before it really kicks off, our heroine, Lily, a very privileged one percenter from Philadelphia. She's a nurse. She's played by Hera Hilmar. By the way, she's Icelandic. She's not British.
Well, I knew she was something. Whatever her accent was, she was not American.
She has an Icelandic accent in this movie. It's not American. They set her up as nurse with a heart of gold. She works in a hospital. They bring a black man in who's bleeding. She wants to save his life, and the whites are like, get him out of our hospital. So she's like, I can't be around this. I have morals. She meets Jude, played by Josh Hartnett, who comes to Philadelphia with tales of, I work in Anatolia, and I have nothing, and I have to save all these people with nothing and my bare hands and fingernails, and she thinks that's amazing. So she raises all this money, gonna buy him a truck, get us medical supplies, and I'm gonna go off, see the world, I'm gonna have an adventure.
She already has the truck. The truck belongs to her dead brother, remember?
And did you catch Titanic? So they show the steamship that she goes over, which I guess would be like the Titanic. It's only 2 years after the real Titanic sunk. But then when they take the truck off said ship, it's exactly the same shot as they take the car off of Titanic in Southampton before they board. I'm like, you sneaky plagiarizing awful people. I'm talking to you, director Joseph Rubin.
I can't believe you got hung up on that, though. This movie has nothing to do with that. It's a love triangle.
It has nothing to do with nothing.
This movie is ultimately a love triangle.
It is a love triangle.
It is a war drama that...
No, it's not a war drama.
That is just... No, but I'm saying that it's the pretext for the plot is a war drama. But then the granted thin plot within that is a love triangle between the doctor at this mission who she had met and this Ottoman lieutenant who is her escort.
I wonder who wins this love triangle considering the title of the movie.
Considering the Ottoman lieutenant is played by Dutch actor Michiel Housman.
You looked that up?
I did look that up so I could pronounce it correctly. And so he was the leading man in The Edge of Adeline, which I had forgotten.
I remember that.
And I liked him
movie.
In that.
That was a good movie.
With Blake Lively probably is why you liked it. And but he's also very well
known.
I know. He's also very well known for Game of Thrones, which I don't watch. But everyone who has seen Game of Thrones is very familiar with this guy. He is the best part of the movie, without a doubt. His performance saves this movie from being really bad in my view.
Well, we have to talk about the atmosphere of the movie. You cannot talk about a film, make a film in World War I, Eastern Turkey, and not talk about the Armenian Genocide. That is when the Turks, the Muslim Turks, slaughtered about 1 million Armenians, trying to wipe them off the map, and they are Christians. And there is a little bit of that in this movie. They had rounded up a couple dozen Armenians. The Turks were picking them off, and your boy, the Ottoman lieutenant, comes to save the day.
Ishmael.
So it kind of – but it sets it up like both sides were good and both sides were bad. Be careful on this subject, filmmakers. You cannot tread lightly on the Armenian Genocide. A movie came out a couple years ago, 2015. It's called The Cut. I really liked it, and that's the one that shows the slaughterhouse of the Armenian Genocide. This one is – about the girl, galloping through fields of golden grass.
And the forbidden romance, you know, the idea that she falls in love with this guy who is the perceived enemy, according to the mission doctor that also has feelings for Lily.
Of course they're going to fall in love because they start out not liking each other.
Of course. No, I mean, it's very predictable. You know where it's going from the get-go, where he's begrudgingly taking her where she needs to go.
And there's a Best Actor Oscar winner in this movie.
Ben Kingsley is the director of this Mission Hospital, and it's a very poorly defined role for him. Very cliche.
He's not excited to see her show up, but I wonder if he'll come around.
Yeah, do you think? Maybe in the end. It's like, you can't recognize Typhus?
Just admit that it's garbage.
It's just that it's not it. I don't know what it was trying to be. It was almost like, okay, we've run out of settings for these romantic drama war movies. So what do we have left? How about the Ottoman Empire? I'm sorry, most people are not going to really understand the setting and the characters and who's fighting who. I got lost. It was like you had the Cossacks and the Russians coming and the Turks and there were moments where it was like, I don't know who's fighting who here, but just get me back to where are we at with the relationship between these three people. And Josh Hartnett, it was not a very good performance by him.
He had nothing to work with.
It was very flat.
He's nowhere near the worst actor in this film, though.
It is the girl. Without a doubt.
It was
terrible casting because you have this this woman who's supposed to be this kind of... wealthy Philadelphian, and she doesn't. Her accent is just so not. It's just so obviously not American.
It moves around a lot.
It moves around a lot, and that's distracting. But the moments, the love story is
not good.
It's okay. The love story's okay.
I looked up the director, and this is nowhere near his first movie. He's been around since the 70s. His most famous, 1991, Sleeping with the Enemy, at the height of Julia Roberts' fame.
Wow.
Followed by 93's The Good Son, when Macaulay Culkin started to fall off. The writer, Jeff Stockwell, he wrote one of my favorite movies from 2002, The Dangerous Lives of Altar Boys. He adapted a very famous children's book in 2007, The Bridge to Terabithia. That had its ups and downs. But this is a shot and a wide miss for both of them.
It's better than Bitter Harvest was for me a week ago. So you missed that one. That was another war drama romance kind of thing, mishmash. And so at least this one had, I do think that in this case, Mikhail Houseman saved this movie from being really bad. I think he is the highlight of this movie. He's very watchable. His character.
I like how you say it. He's watchable.
His character.
Take your shirt off a lot.
He's the Tom Hiddleston of, you know, you've got Tom Hiddleston in Kong this week. You have Mikhail Houseman in this one. Of course, the two aren't even. You can't compare it. It's going to get crushed.
Well, you know who you have in our next film, The Last Word? Someone who also takes off her clothes. Shirley MacLaine. Shirley MacLaine takes off her clothes in The Last Word.
From a distance, in the dark.
It's in the dark. It's a skinny dipping scene, but you know, I thought it was funny. Like there was a guy in the audience who lost his mind.
Well, he loved everything in that movie.
So The Last Word, I just have to set the scene. We saw it with a theater full of AARP members.
Yes, the people who are invited by the AARP Movies for Grown-Ups.
Shirley MacLaine is the kind of person who controls everything. She's a control freak, and that's why she was very successful in business. That's why her house, her McMansion, is pristine. It's why she's driven all of her family and friends away because they can't stand her, and it's why she wants to write or control her own obituary. You know, she's in her 80s. She can see the end. She's tired. She wants someone to write her obituary while she's still alive so she can sign off on it. And that person is Amanda Seyfried.
Yeah.
Kind of a backwater newspaper. And they form, I'll just go ahead and say, this professional assignment for, what's her name, Anne. It also turns personal, and she grows as a person.
Well, you're missing the humor of it, though. The premise is actually...
I'm sure there was supposed to be humor in it.
The premise is better than that. The premise is, you know, here you've got this Shirley MacLaine's character, Harriet Lawler, is reading through the obits, which a lot of people of that age tend to do because they are going to spot people that they know and they know what these people were truly like. And so she's reading these obits that are incredibly well written and make these people sound so wonderful. And so her whole thing is she's like, these people were not great. These make them sound like these wonderful, awesome people, and they weren't. And so that's why she then decides that she needs to make sure that that her obituary has that same flowery stuff going for it. And she thinks that she should. She thinks she should have this legacy that's remembered. And when she gives Anne this, when she basically forces the editor of the paper to give Anne the assignment to write her obituary, you know, she's like, here are all these people you can interview. And of course, everybody hates Harriet. And so there's nothing for this poor writer to work with. And they decide to sort of go about creating a new legacy for her so that they will, in the end, check off all the boxes that will make her into what, at least on the surface, looks like a great person. And that's where the story goes. And yeah, Shirley MacLaine
plays Shirley MacLaine.
She plays, I mentioned to you that she her character is almost identical to the character she played in Guarding Tess.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And I noticed, I remember, she reminds me of Weezer from Steel Magnolias.
Yeah.
Just as cranky and cantankerous. She's not as comic relief as that.
But, I mean, she's 82, or maybe 2,500, depending on whether or not you buy into her whole, isn't she into the whole reincarnation thing?
Hey, let's keep religion out of this.
So she's either 82 or much older. But for 82, for her to actually look like essentially the exact same character that she played in the 1994 movie Guarding Tess.
She does.
It's quite impressive. And so for anyone who likes watching Shirley MacLaine in a Shirley MacLaine role, they'll enjoy this movie. The people who came out of that movie, the mature audience, I would say, enjoyed it.
They enjoyed it because they have grown up with Shirley MacLaine. Mm-hmm. They really remember her from 1960 against Jack Lemmon in The Apartment. And, you know, this movie tries to shock that audience. They know who their audience is going to be. It's going to be the elderly. And it wants to shock them. So it has these throwaway, terrible lines like, she puts the bitch in obituary.
Yes.
And a line that makes us roll our eyes because it's ridiculous. But it makes the elderly go, oh, I can't believe they said that.
I'm sure that guy in the front chuckled tremendously.
There was a guy, I can't stop thinking about this guy. Every single terrible joke or every single plot turn he went, whoa!
He was like the Ed McMahon of the movie-going audience.
I don't think he has seen a film since 1960's The Apartment. That's how shocked he was at everything.
Here's the final, the deal, though, is that Shirley MacLaine is good. The script fails her. Well, she does not fail this movie. The movie fails her.
Did you pick up I found an undercurrent of feminism. They wanted to talk about it. She became a very successful businesswoman in an era where that didn't really happen. She started her own business and became very rich, and she was in the vast minority of women to do that. And then the film throws it away. They don't talk about it. And then the whole thing when she just walks into the radio station one day, it's like, I'm going to be a DJ now. And she just wheels in her radio flyer wagon full of LPs. And it's setting up Anne as this big indie person. She doesn't tell anyone she's a real writer. She doesn't just write obits. She hides behind her door at night, scribbles away in her little diary, her essays, and she doesn't let anybody read. But she carries around the journal all day to make people ask, what's in the journal? And she acts so offended when you ask. My favorite part of the movie, trying to make her so indie, she comes home one night, she cracks open a beer, and she quotes the radio station, indie music for indie minds, and then she drinks her Dos Equis and makes sure the camera sees the Dos Equis. I'm like, way to go,
product placement,
indie girl. But I want to get away from the movie and talk about something bigger, something that I've noticed the last couple of years. Tell me if I'm wrong, or tell me if, like, oh my
wrong,
God, you're
go
so
ahead.
Right. When you think, who is loud in movie theaters? You think kids. Kids talk all the time. You always hear the parents go, shh, or teenagers who are just screwing around in the back during King Kong. It's not. And I've noticed this for the past 5-6 years. Old people talk all the time during movies, and it's every old people movie.
Well, watch your definition of old.
No,
though.
You know
these
what I'm talking.
Old,
no,
but the
I'm
mature 70s. Audience.
I'm talking 70 and older. They can't whisper anymore, so they talk in full, complete sentences about the plot or about that girl's hair.
I think they're
so loud.
I think that's a rather broad stroke you're painting
every
there.
Every single
I don't think
movie
that's fair.
Catering to this demographic.
I think there's always one or two. In this case, there were two. There was the woman near us who was talking pretty much nonstop throughout the whole thing, and the loud chuckler down in front. So you're talking two.
I dread going to movies like this because I know I'm going to hear the commentary. Give me a kid's movie any day when you just hear the giggles and that, mommy, did you see that? Over, oh my God,
but
you remember Shirley
same
MacLaine from 1973? And
but they're reacting the same way to what they're saying as the kids are to what they're saying. So
and they're louder about it and more obnoxious.
Sometimes. So it definitely, in the case of this last movie, there was quite a bit of that. But I would be wary of categorizing all that particular demographic when I do think that it's one of those things like there's always one, and there's always the person who turns on their phone and is texting, and so I do understand that we saw it and we heard it and it was distracting and disruptive and annoying, but it was also kind of comical in its own way.
Well, it was the best thing about the movie, because to sum up, this is a garbage movie. It is not good.
It's not garbage. It's okay. It has way too many. It's cliche.
It has a 9-year-old in it
whose sole
purpose is to shock you with her foul language. Well, and it takes you so out of it. When Shirley MacLaine says, listen, this is the word I just learned, and then she defines it and tells you how to use it. It's ridiculous.
Well, that whole character could be interpreted in many different ways as being potentially very stereotypically racist, I would say.
I think so.
With how that relationship is portrayed. I mean, it's all meant to be good natured, but it's a little awkward. And the girl, it's like basically one of the boxes that Harriet needs to check off in order for her to have this great obit is to basically mentor some disadvantaged youth, preferably a minority. And that's sort of how that is, how that's set up. And they go in search of.
And she's in scenes when she needs to be in scenes. She's absent when she needs to be absent. And it's just there to react.
So I don't think this movie is terrible. It's just not very good. And it is it's fine for Shirley MacLaine fans who want to sort of see Shirley MacLaine do the Shirley MacLaine thing. And that's pretty much it. Another one that's not even going to gain much traction when you've got nothing's going to be able to battle King Kong anyway. But if you are a member of that mature audience that wants to see a Shirley MacLaine movie where at least her role is good, then this might be okay. I wouldn't rush out and see it. You probably could rent it, watch it on an airplane. It certainly does not need to be seen on a big screen.
Well, you have to watch it on an airplane because anywhere else you want to throw yourself out the window.
And rated R is ridiculous because honestly the only thing that makes this movie rated R is a string of F-words uttered by the 9-year-old.
It's explicit, but no, compared to the intestines I see fly across the screen nowadays, it should be PG-13.
It should be PG-13.
So our next film is by a very, very busy man, Pablo Larraine. The reason you know that name is because he had 3 films released last year in American theaters. We've talked about 2 of them, and here's just the third. The first one we talked about was The Club. Last year's Oscars. It was nominated for Best Foreign Film out of Chile. I really like that movie. You didn't see it, which is why you're looking at me with a puzzle on your face. But we talked about it on this podcast.
We know his name. I'm like, I don't know his name.
But you know his name because he directed Jackie.
Okay,
Natalie Portman in Jackie. But he also directed Neruda, about Chile's patron saint of poetry, Pablo Neruda. So busy, busy man. Pablo Neruda is a revered figure in Chile, and you have to, I think, to really understand and jive with this movie, you need to know about Chilean politics from the 1940s.
Yes.
And there's a long voiceover at the beginning that tells you about Chilean politics in the 1940s. It was going right wing. It was going severely right wing. Neruda was a communist. He was no longer welcome. And he said, you know, he saw what was going on with the government. He spoke out. They wanted to arrest him. So now he's on the lam. He's running away. He's trying to get over the Andes into Argentina to escape. And there's a fictional policeman on his tail. So his escape to Argentina was real. That happened in real life. The Gael Garcia Bernal character, the detective Oscar Pelicanu, is fake. They pulled him out of thin air. And Neruda didn't grab me. It was nominated for Best Foreign Film in all the Critics Awards. Washington, D.C. Film Critics, the Critics' Choice Awards, New York Times Film Critics, all the film critics. It was not nominated for a Best Foreign Film Oscar. In fact, I think A Man Called Uwe took its place.
As well it should.
And I can see why. I did not enjoy this film. I got bored. I liked a previous film from a couple decades ago about Neruda. It was called Il Postino. That was nominated.
Oh, I remember that one.
That was a good movie. This one, I just wanted it to end.
Well, my colleague Artie Chick loved this movie. She did. But she also knows, she is familiar with Chilean politics and the aspect of the poetry politician, and so there were a lot of things that she really liked about it. When you talk about that long voiceover at the beginning, I tuned out. That was what did me in, was I had a hard time getting through that long voiceover setting this whole thing up. I was like, I'm already bored of this story, and the movie itself has barely begun. And so I checked out probably about 30 to 40 minutes into it when I just realized that it just simply is not my cup of tea. It is strictly for the art house crowd. And it is, I'm sure, a very smart, cerebral movie. I couldn't get into it. And I really was not familiar with the political happenings in Chile in the time period. And it's not a story that I particularly was keen to catch up on when there was so much else coming out at the same time. And it's not one that I just can really consider myself likely to go back and catch up on, even though I do like Garcia Bernal.
It's a very low fourth out of the four Pablo Larraine films I've seen. Remember, he also did 2012's Oscar-nominated No, about the vote on whether or not to kick out Pinochet. Great film. This shares the same writer as The Club, Guillermo Calderon. And I don't know why. I think this must have really struck home with Chilean audiences who still know everything about Neruda and still revere him as a person and now a myth and a legend. And this cat and mouse, it's a cat and mouse game. Mm-hmm. You know, the detective Oscar is just always one step behind Neruda and you're like, ooh, are they going to get him? And this shows you Neruda was a man. He was rough and grumpy and a philanderer and an adulterer on his wife who he's stringing along, and he imposes himself on his friend's apartment as he's hiding out. So warts and all, Pablo Neruda was a man, not just a legend. And yeah, if you want to find out about that, check out Neruda, but blech, I wouldn't.
Well, and I think if considering I gave it all of about 10 minutes before I checked out, I don't think...
Did you only watch 10 minutes of the movie?
I don't know. I think I had it on for longer than that, but seriously, the voiceover was enough for me. And it just was not something I was terribly interested in. And, you know, I'm selective about what foreign films I like. And so A Man Called Uwe by far was more enjoyable to me. So I certainly could never recommend a mainstream audience going to see Neruda, whereas I can recommend a mainstream audience see A Man Called Uwe.
Well, our next film you did not see.
Not at all.
Because not only is it a trilogy, but for three reasons you didn't see this, and I'll tell you why. Because it's old. It's from the early 1930s. You do not watch movies from the early 1930s. It's in black and white. Usually, and it's...
I like the artist.
Usually don't watch movies in black and white. And it's a trilogy that took me over 7 hours to watch.
Mm-hmm.
That's another reason you didn't watch this movie. But I'll tell you the reasons you should watch this movie. It's called the Marseille Trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from France. It's filmed, takes place in Marseille. And it was written by a guy from just outside of Marseille. And it's a brand new 4K digital restoration. So you've got what used to be this very grainy and scratchy footage from 1931, 1932, 1936. And it is crystal clear and it's so gorgeous to watch. And so it's all put together by a man named Marcel Pagnol. He wrote all three films. He was a playwright, so the first two films in the trilogy were plays. And then he wrote the standalone one, third. But he only directed one of them. He directed the last one. And they're named after their main characters. So 1931, Marius, 1932, Fanny, and 1936, César. I loved the first two films here. The third one can go take a flying leap. But the story boils down to, it's a will-they-won't-they between a guy and a girl over 20 years. So you can call it tragicomic, if you will. It's funny. César, the barman, he's a gruff guy. He knows everything. He's the town busybody. And he just owns the screen. You really just like to watch him. It takes place in his bar, usually on the waterfront of Marseille. It's just a time and a place that I just really enjoyed. I knew nothing about Marseille. I've never been there. I saw it a couple years ago in like the new Transporter. It looked really bad. But I just had so much fun watching, except for the last movie, which is over 2.5 hours long. And it takes place 20 years in the future. It just did not do it for me. It's the kind of movie where people are always into each other's business. What are you doing? Where are you going? And, you know, the characters deepen and they change. And I really fell in love with some of these characters, Hannah.
I take it it's in French.
Very much. In fact, I learned it's in the colloquial Marseille French. Like, there's idioms that French people would have a tough time.
And I'm so relieved that once again, Charlie, you are able to single-handedly pull the French film industry back from the brink for American audiences. Because I don't know what they would do without you. Because I can always count on you to highlight a good French film.
You watched Elle. You didn't hate it.
Mm-hmm.
I think if this were film, they remade these a couple years ago. I didn't see them, but if you watched the first two, I do not think you would hate these films.
I'm sure. I it's very possible I would not. So when I find 5 hours to watch those first two, I will let you know.
Really 2.5 because the third one's the long one. I just had a blast. Like, I never even heard of the Marseille Trilogy. And here they are just re-releasing it into special art house theaters in very, very big cities. So it's not probably coming to your neck of the woods, St. Pete.
Well, for chick flicks, I'm going to recommend that Artie Chick seek it out and watch it. And I will wait for her feedback, and then I will find the consensus and determine oui or no on the Marseille trilogy.
I know you watch General Hospital. There's a lot of soap opera in here, which is why I think you would connect.
Could be. But I'm 5 hours behind on General Hospital this week. So I don't know. It's a really tough call. Do I watch the Marseille trilogy in French with subtitles? Oh. Or do I watch General Hospital on my DVR where I can actually like zip through and get the key story points in about a total of an hour?
I just think the biggest nightmare I could ever think of on Earth is watching this seven and a half hour marathon of awesome French movies surrounded by old people talking. What? What did he read?
I don't know. I think someday, Charlie, that's your future.
And that's fine. I will go annoy the next generation as I speak too loudly in the theater, offering my witty commentary about Shirley MacLaine taking her pants off. Fine. All right, to wrap up.
Yes, please do.
You saw Kong Skull Island. I liked Godzilla. I liked 2005's King Kong.
You will probably like this one. Monster movie fans, go for it. Everyone else, if you haven't seen all the other monster movies, you're not going to particularly care for this one.
The Ottoman Lieutenant is bad for you, and it will make you a worse person than you already are if you go see it. So don't go see it.
Yeah, if you happen to stumble across it on an airplane or something, then it might be okay if you're just looking for a love triangle. But beyond that, probably okay to skip.
The last word is bad for you, and it will probably make you a worse person than you already are if you go and see it.
No, the last word has its moments, and I think the last word belongs to Shirley MacLaine, and so I think you should give her her due.
Neruda, if you're a Pablo Larraine completist, if you wanted to talk about one of the more talked about foreign films from last year, which is probably number 6 on the Oscar-nominated foreign films, it was the one that just was left out. I have a feeling that it was. Then it's for you. Otherwise, steer clear. Not for you.
Yeah, if you're a fan of Chile, politics, and poetry, then maybe. Otherwise, go see A Man Called Ove.
The Marseille trilogy, you do not need to know about 1931 France or Marseille or French politics at the time, because these characters are universal, Hannah.
I will take your word for that one, Charlie.
All right, on behalf of the Cinema Clash, thank you very much for listening. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.